Hello, I'm Amanda McNulty with Clemson Extension and Making It Grow, and this is a Making It Grow podcast, and we are interviewing and talking today with David Coyle, who is a professor in the Department of, goodness, David, you'll have to say it for me.
I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Forestry and Environmental Conservation at Clemson University.
But you have some special subsets that you're particularly focusing on, correct?
That's right. I work in forest health and invasive species. So anything that impacts a tree, whether it's in a yard or in a forest or any of the invasive species, a lot of the invasive plants, I work with those pretty commonly.
And if I'm not mistaken, you have some extension responsibilities, which means that you can talk to people when some of the professors are too busy doing research.
Well, I try. Yeah, my appointment is 100% extension. You know, I do a little bit of research with that, but most of what I do is extension, whether it's in person or online like this, or writing fact sheets and that type of thing. So it's a big part of my day.
Well, a lot of people in South Carolina are now becoming concerned about the spread of what they still probably call Bradford pears, and because the ones that are coming up don't just have flowers that smell bad but look pretty. They have some real dangers associated with them and are actually putting some farmland that's not kept up, if you're not just out there every whip stitch, makes it unusable. So talk about what's happened with what we thought was going to be such a wonderful tree for a while there.
Yeah, it was a wonderful tree for a while. The Bradford pear is what it is. And it, you know, it was this thing was originally brought to North America back in the early 1900s by a fella working for the USDA at the time. They had a group, an organization that their whole mission was to bring plants in from other places to see if we could use them for something worthwhile here in the States. They brought these in because we had a young pear industry, mostly in the Pacific Northwest, where we use the European pears. And those are the ones that produce the fruit that we eat. So they were getting this bacterial disease called fire blight. And fire blight is this disease where it gets transferred from flower to flower, generally by insect pollinators. And it causes the tips of the branches and the fruit to sort of blacken and wither and wilt. So it makes the fruit unusable. So there was a really big fire blight problem. And they brought in these trees from China, where these came from, Pyrus caloriana. So they brought those in because they had some fire blight resistance in them. They took them, they planted a whole bunch in Glendale, Maryland, which is just up by Washington, D.C., as sort of our, you know, the stock planting there. And then they grafted European pears onto the rootstock of these Calabri pears. What that did was confer some of that resistance to fire blight into the European pears and kind of save the pear industry. So in that respect, bringing them over accomplished the objective. It worked, right? They saved that pear industry. They got the fire blight resistance in there. One of those trees, as you know, all those Calabri pears were growing there in that Glendale, Maryland facility. One of the trees had all these characteristics of a great street tree. And this was noticed by John Creech, who was the director of the station at the time. He noticed that this tree had, you know, pretty white flowers, a nice kind of lollipop shape to it. It was resistant to drought and insects and fungi. Basically, you could just not care for it and it thrived.
And good fall color as well.
And yes, bright red in the fall, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. And I think this was happening when we were beginning to see the massive rise of suburbs and people looking for street trees because we were expanding residential neighborhoods so dramatically during that time.
Right, yeah, and in the 60s or so is when this sort of happened, right? Late 50s, early 60s. So he saw this one individual tree. He saw all these great characteristics for a street tree in there. He named it the Bradford pear, and Bradford was the former station director, so it was named after him. So that's where the Bradford pear came from. It was this one tree. And what they did was they took that Bradford pear tree and they grafted it onto all these other Pyrus caloriana rootstocks. So every Bradford pear out there has the same stuff on top, the same genetics on top, but every root is different. It's the same species, but it's different genetics.
So because of that, is that why it didn't set viable seed? Because it was the same?
Absolutely right. So the Bradford pears by themselves are, they call it self-incompatible. Two Bradfords cannot make a viable seed. But if you've got pollen from anything else coming in there, it can make a viable seed. So what they, so that means if you've got 100 Bradford pears in a row and they're all Bradford pear, you're not going to get any viable seed out of that. But all it takes is one not Bradford pear, whether that's a different, you know, one of the European pears or a one of those other Pyrus caloriana rootstocks to grow up, and then that can pollinate all those other Bradfords and you get viable seed from there. So they started planting these Bradford pears in towns all over the, you know, all over the eastern US first. Everybody loved it. I think it won some horticultural awards. It was such a, you know, such a prize, you know, Bradford pear, prize street tree. And but even as early as the mid-1960s, it was noticed that this thing was escaping. So they were seeing populations of this tree in natural areas, ditches and that type of thing, you know, and they're really easy to notice, especially in the springtime. They're one of the first trees that flowers, those, you know, beautiful white flowers all over. So it's pretty easy to notice those, especially in spring.
And David, let me interrupt for just a moment. So the introduction of other pears, trees from that initial planting, there was even apparently they went back and tried to find some others that had good characteristics. And so some of those were planted. And then also you said probably there were root shoots that came up from the graft, the bottom, the root graft, which would have, if they, when they flowered, they would have had the pollen necessary to make viable seeds. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. So you can have a situation where maybe someone just has one Bradford pear tree planted in their yard. All it takes is a shoot to grow up from the roots, right? And these roots, they're well known. They send up sprouts all over the place. People that have Bradfords in their yard always talk about how many little Bradfords are popping up all over the place growing off the roots. So if one of those shoots grows off that root right next to the Bradford, that's a different thing. And so you can have that tree, basically the bottom of the tree pollinating the top of the tree.
Okay. All right. Okay. So all of a sudden, viable seed. So all of a sudden we've got these things, and you're right, they're very noticeable. Mm-hmm. So people are starting to see them, and unfortunately they have some different characteristics that make them kind of dangerous and difficult to work with.
Right. These things, you know, when they, Bradford was chosen specifically, one of the reasons it was chosen is it didn't have thorns. Pyrus caloriana has lots of thorns of different shapes and sizes. Some are long, you know, 3 inches long and really skinny. Others are only a half inch long, but they're incredibly stout and strong. So once you get these outcrosses or these crossings where it's, you know, not a Bradford with something else, the thorns come back with the. So a lot of those, you know, if you ever are driving down the road and you see a patch of wild calorie pear, if you go look at that thing, there will be thorns out there. I can guarantee each tree is going to be a little bit different. There's all sizes, but that's one of the things that comes back is those thorns.
And that makes control of those very difficult, because to get in there, even if it's just one in your own yard, you've got to be very careful because those things can poke you, can puncture you. And then in fields, I understand that they just destroy tires.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've shed a fair amount of blood to these things working in them the last few years. They'll puncture skin very easily. So it's tough to get in there. You know, one thing that's easy to do with a tree that you don't want there is you can cut it down, but that's easier said than done with these, because you've got to lift up a bunch of really dangerous branches to try to get in there. They seem to take over old fields a lot, and not just old fields, but pastures, right-of-ways, kind of anywhere like that. They'll grow quite quickly and quite commonly. And a lot of those thorns, like you said, they're strong enough to puncture tires on pickups and wagons and tractors. And we've had a lot of landowners tell us, you know, what do we do? We spent all this money and all this time trying to fix tires. There's not a good answer for that. You know, these things, we can manage them. We can use different herbicides that will kill them, which is great. But then you've still got this dead, woody, thorny tree, right? So that's still there. We know that if you prescribe fire is a commonly used management tool here for our forests, for pastures, some of the old fields, some of that. We have some data. One of our undergrads did a project where he looked at the impact of fire on the thorns, and you can reduce the chance of tire puncture by burning the thorns off, you know, which kind of makes sense if you think about it, because if a fire burns a thorn, the tip gets a little more dull and it just makes it more brittle in general. So that might be something we can have folks do, is we'll try to do a prescribed fire first to try to burn off some of that, so you're not gonna, you know, pop a tire every time you drive over it.
But that's not a tool that we can use in every situation. Every place would lend itself to having a burn.
No, and you know, that's the unfortunate thing, is a lot of places where calorie repair really gets going is around suburban areas, around neighborhoods, and kind of on the outskirts of neighborhoods. And honestly, the north side of Columbia is a great example. You've got neighborhoods all over the place up there. When they were put in the 90s, you know, there was a Bradford pear plopped in every yard. And now you've got calorie pear all over the place on the north side of Columbia. And obviously you're not going to burn there. There's schools, there's residential areas, there's businesses. So you're left with, what do you do about this? And there's not a lot of good answers right now.
You said there's some kind of mulching machine that has tank-like treads that can mm-hmm. be brought in. Talk about that. Can it knock down a 20-foot tall tree? And you'd have to, where are they available?
Yeah, so there's these machines. A lot of times they're just a machine head you can put on the front of a skid loader or a bobcat, right?
Okay. So
put that thing on there and it will just kind of grind stuff up as it's going. There's larger ones you may have seen on the side of the road when they do kind of road clearing for the DOT. There's different sizes, but the size we most commonly see is something on the front of a bobcat, and that can take trees up to 12, 15 feet tall. 20 might be getting a little bit big. And honestly, by the time they're getting 20 feet tall, the canopy is starting to raise up a little bit on them. So you can get under there with a saw when they get that big.
Oh, okay.
When they're grown in kind of an open area, they have almost a Christmas tree like shape. They've got a canopy that comes really low to the ground, and then come up, mm-hmm. not a straight triangle, but you know, the canopy sits very low and it's a very full canopy. But as they get bigger, the canopy kind of raises. Some of those bottom branches die off, and you can get under there and cut those things down. But still, everywhere there's a branch, there's a thorn. And on some of them, you get thorns on the stem too. So it's tricky. Once you get a place that's loaded with them, your options are kind of limited, unfortunately.
So it's just, is it a nationwide problem? Is it all over the United States now?
Right now, we're seeing the calorie pear issue. It's all over the southeastern and most of the eastern U.S. We recently did some work where we collected samples from kind of all over. I think some of our more northern samples were New Jersey, New Hampshire. We've got them all the way over to Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, kind of that area. That's where kind of the limits of what we see, the calorie pear issue. Now, Bradford pear has been planted all over the country, right? There's Bradfords planted in northern Idaho all the way to Southern California. There's Bradford pears, you know, up to Washington State. There's Bradford pears planted everywhere. As of right now, there are not wild calorie pear populations there that I know of. I would guess it's a matter of time, though.
I see.
You know, that's my hunch. Some have guessed it hasn't happened in Southern California, for instance, because it's such a different climate.
I see.
But I would go back to that stuff that Frank Meyer wrote in his journal back in the early 1900s. He wrote about all the different places calorie pear was growing.
He's the person who collected them. And what did he say in his journal about them?
He said, and I'll paraphrase, something to the effect of, calorie pear is found growing on rocky hillsides, in deep floodplains, on the side of mountains, in open fields. He basically wrote that he found this thing growing everywhere, right? And this should have been our key that this is not a good idea to bring this over. You know, 100 years ago, we had a different mentality towards such things, right? We've learned a lot as a society since then. But that's exactly what made it attractive as something to graft with fruit trees. Because if you graft this on there, that means those fruit trees will survive anything. And that means they're going to keep producing fruit and everything. So that's how that all fed into each other.
Well, it's almost an insurmountable problem considering all the other things that we have facing us these days. But at least letting people realize that it isn't a tree that should be planted because they're still being offered for sale, and that you can at least take responsibility in your own landscape. And I think you found some places where they were promoting ways of doing that and brought that idea to Clemson recently. Tell us what y'all did up there, please, David.
Yes, we did what we call the Bradford Pear Bounty Program. So I saw this program last year. The city of Fayetteville, Arkansas had one of these, and there was a community outside St. Louis, Missouri. They had these where they asked residents to cut down their Bradford pear in their yard, bring a picture of that tree that was cut down as proof, and then they got a free native trees replacement. So I got a hold of these folks, and we did a similar thing in Clemson this year, the end of February. We asked people, not just in the city of Clemson, but in the, you know, upstate, throughout the state, cut down your Bradford, bring us a picture of your Bradford cut down, and we'll give you a free native tree. And we had several native tree species we gave away. We know that we're not going to get rid of every calorie pear in Bradford out there. That's just not feasible at this point. But I think one of the important things we can do is help people figure out there's a lot of great native trees that can be planted in a yard that probably should be planted in a yard instead of a Bradford pear. And in a lot of cases, folks just don't know what their options are, right? They see, maybe they see what the neighbor has, or maybe they go to one of the box stores and they see these, you know, flowering pear trees and they just think, oh, put those in. But, you know, part of what we do as extension is try to help people learn about what are your options and what can we do. So that was a big part of what we did with this program, is just try to get people thinking about and talking about planting a native tree, because we've got a lot of great native trees around that just don't get used maybe as often as they could or should. So that was
you great. Mentioned some of them to me, and tell me again some of the ones that you were able to acquire, and that you were able to acquire good size trees. It wasn't just a little teeny thing and a, you know, pint, you know, you right. 3 gallon trees, good size trees and a good selection.
Yes, we had 10 total species. And again, like you said, there were 3 gallon pots. So some of them, the American beech was only a couple feet tall, but I believe it was the overcup oak was 7 feet tall. I
mean, beautiful tree.
Yeah. So overcup oak, American beech, swamp chestnut oak, black gum, bald cypress, dogwood, viburnum bush, sweet bay magnolia, and there were a couple others too that are escaping my memory at this point. But we had a pretty good selection of native trees, good sized trees, you know, because you and I talked earlier that we wanted people to be excited about this program. And if they came to this program to get excited and we gave them a little spindly 8-inch long seedling, that's not exciting. So we tried to get some resources together between the city of Clemson and the Forestry Commission and get some really good sized trees so they can, you know, we want them to take home a big tree where they can put something in the ground, see some leaves right away this spring, see some, maybe even flowers or some color this fall. That's going to help everyone's attitude. And then hopefully they tell their friends and neighbors about it. And if we can do this again next year, we'll have an even bigger response.
Well, and one thing I think that's exciting is those trees are hard to find if I just go to a garden center.
Yeah. But
the more diversity we have, the better off we are in case something happens. I think we're going to talk in another chat about ash trees. And so if you just have predominantly one genus of tree there, you can really run into trouble if something happens. So what you're doing as well is encouraging diversity, because you were able to go and find trees that were and get them out to people and kind of develop an interest in them. People are going to say, gosh, what's that beautiful tree you've got? Where'd you get it? I'd like to have one of those too. So I commend you for that as well.
Thanks. Yeah, that was the goal. You know, we got trees that you're not going to just go to a box store and get. You know, these were orders from a commercial nursery. We worked with, again, the city and the state, and we got them wholesale, and we got stuff that you just don't find everywhere. I mean, you can see it in the woods or parks and that type of thing, but not a lot of people have these trees in their yard. And they're beautiful trees. You know, some are the spring flowers. A lot of them had really great fall foliage color. So hopefully this fall, when, you know, neighbors start seeing some of these trees that were planted, they'll start asking about, well, what is that? Well, that's a black gum. And, you know, we'll start getting people to kind of think outside the box a little bit when it comes to what's in my yard or what's in the yard.
And also, I think by encouraging planting of native trees, you're segueing into this interest that people have of native trees being the larval food source for caterpillars. I mean, for butterflies and moths. And you know, and as Doug Tallamy has been so effective in communicating to people, we all need to have that mindset because of the dramatic decline we've seen in our bird populations. And so we need to grow caterpillars to feed our birds. And to grow caterpillars, you need native trees because of coevolution. So you're just getting it all brought in together. I think that's very exciting.
Thanks. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, there's a lot of good information out there that shows where you've got neighborhoods dominated by non-native plants, you've got less caterpillars and less birds. And it seems like a funny link to make, but there's a lot of birds that just feed their young nothing but caterpillars. And I think they said a chickadee, which is a fairly, you know, small creature, needs several thousand caterpillars just to raise a clutch of eggs every spring. And so very, very few things eat calorie pear or Bradford pear. What I like to tell people is anytime you see a Bradford pear out there, if you like birds, think of that as a food desert for a bird, right? So a bird is not going to find any caterpillars on there to eat. It's got to go somewhere else. So the more of those things that are out there, the less caterpillars, the less insects we have, which is, from a bird's perspective, the less food is available there. So that's another good reason to plant natives is stuff eats them. And, you know, a little bit of feeding is not going to hurt the tree. It's not going to hurt the look of the tree. It's just kind of nature doing its thing, right? And if you like having all that nature around, it's important to have those native plants there.
Well, this has been an interesting topic for me. I see these, I used to think it was more of a problem in the upstate, and I had to go to Charleston recently and noticed that the areas by the highway were just completely filled with them. And so it really is a massive problem in our, and then in my own community, there's a place where they planted one and the business has gone out of, you know, it's no longer up and running and they don't mow around that tree. And now it's just a whole grove of them and it can happen pretty quickly. So I think, you know, it's like we said, it's a really big problem and we can't just take it out overnight, but we can take personal responsibility, at least within our own yard. And then sometimes I think there are groups that are adopting certain areas that have ecological importance. And are going in and trying to do some invasive species removal. And I think that's another thing that you work on. We may talk later about the project that you're involved with in my home county of Calhoun County, where y'all are doing that right here. I'm so glad that you're now a member of Clipson's family and sharing your knowledge and experience and your enthusiasm and willingness to say, let's try something new to try to teach people how they can become better stewards of our state and the world. David, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Amanda.